Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa Week begins today, and all week long, we'll be asking the question, is this home? Today, we begin by exploring the waves of migration throughout Iowa history. I'll talk with historian Tim Walsh, and Jocelyn Hickey Johnson will share her family's journey from Water Valley, Mississippi to Waterloo, Iowa, part of the Great Migration. But first, Iowa Public Radio talk show producer Matt Alvarez traveled to the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch to attend a naturalization ceremony. After the ceremony, he talked with some of Iowa's newest citizens.
My first name is Jonathan, last name Konga. I'm originally from Congo. And I moved here to college with my mom and also just the opportunity out here.
What do you do?
Kirkwood Community College as a financial counselor, so I'm a financial counselor for U.S., you know, most of the immigrant folks, so I help them filling out the FAFSA and also complete their, you know, just make sure they understand, you know, what they're getting themselves into, you know, in college and stuff.
Do you plan to stay in Iowa?
From now, yes. Yeah, I like the place, so it's pretty quiet and the opportunity is good.
Well, what do you like the most about it?
To be honest, I'm not sure about the weather because I like California weather. And I think college football, maybe. Yeah, college football and also the friends that I made.
Marilyn Rochigan.
And where are you from?
Philippines.
And why did you choose Iowa?
Oh, I love Iowa because its people are gentle people, loving, friendly people. I'll stay the rest of my life in Iowa with my husband.
My first name is Bibish and my last name is Sharifa.
And where are you from again?
Congo.
Do you like it here?
Very. I like America. It's different for Africa. America, everybody is, we are freedom in America. In my country, you know, police not do job. You can work around, you can wear jewelry, you can work by night, people, I don't know. So America is good. If you are hard, you got money in America, you work. Everybody is good in America. I love America. Yeah. Just I say thank you, God. Thank you for this journey. It's big, famous for me. Big journey for me. Thank you again.
Prem Chetri.
Where are you from?
Bhutan.
Where's that?
It's near of India. And I move because in our country, there are so crime and people used to kill one another and it's not good to live in that country. So we just live from there. And they were not giving us good opportunity to do something because we are from refugee camp. We are refugee. So that's why we move here, because United States, this America give very good opportunity to do all people. They will give all opportunity to go to school, to study, all of them.
How do you feel about today?
I am so happy. Yes, I am so happy because I am the United States of, I'm citizen of United States. Yes, I am so happy.
The voices of some of Iowa's newest citizens recorded after a naturalization ceremony that took place last week in West Branch. Now, people have been coming to Iowa from all over the world for more than 200 years. And before we take a historical look at migration, we'll find out more about the people who are coming to Iowa now. Michelle Devlin is a professor of global public health and an emergency medical technician in the Department of Health, Recreation and Community Services at the University of Northern Iowa. She's with me now. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, Charity. Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And of course, people are still coming to Iowa. We hear a lot about immigration in the news, but people are still finding their way to Iowa. Can you give me sort of an overview of who's coming to Iowa now?
Sure. Well, our patterns of migration have really changed quite a bit, especially in about the past 10 years or so, since the Postville immigration raid and other changes nationally that have gone on. And what we're seeing now in the state of Iowa is a similar pattern that we're seeing to other rural states and neighboring states, is that we have an influx of refugees that are being recruited by various companies to come here in the state, and they are here legally on green cards or refugee status, and or as citizens or as secondary migrants coming in from other states. And so they are being recruited because of changes in our population that we have in the state. We are becoming older. Our population is older. The size of our families is shrinking. We're not having as many children. For a long while, we actually had a fair amount of out-migration of our young people that would graduate, and many of them, about 50%, would leave for other states. Now that trend has reversed a bit. But because of that, we have had a labor shortage in key areas of our economy in the state. And due to that, again, we have different organizations, different industries are recruiting refugees and other kinds of populations to come here to Iowa.
So we really need workers in Iowa is what I hear you're saying. Tell me a little bit more about the kinds of work that they're being recruited to do.
Sure. It's a real mix in the state. For instance, we see in our agricultural processing industries, meatpacking and others, we have a large influx of refugees from all around the world that are working in those industries legally. So a lot of Southeast Asians, for instance, people from the country of Myanmar or was formerly known as Burma. We have a large influx, thousands of Burmese now in the state. We have refugees from the Horn of Africa, from Ethiopia, Eritrea. We have large refugee populations from the Congo, from Bhutan, up in High Asia near Nepal, as Matt interviewed one of those folks that had just become a citizen recently. So lots of different refugees being recruited to do that kind of work. Some of them are secondary migrants. They are already here in the United States, in other states, and then they're being recruited to come to Iowa. And then we also have a shortage of people working in skilled industries, for instance, physicians and engineers. And so those folks are being recruited on often H-1B visas and coming in from countries like India and others to do this kind of skilled work. So we are now, we believe we're well over 180 languages in the state of Iowa. And if you go into some of our smaller towns and communities, you easily in the school districts may be looking at 70, 80, 90 different nationalities of people and of families within these communities.
I think just in that naturalization ceremony that Matt attended, there were 27 people from 23 different nations. So that gives you a little snapshot of the kind of diversity that we're talking about. Now, you've mentioned secondary migration a couple of times, and I think a lot of people think, okay, refugees just come to the United States. They come from wherever they are, and some of them wind up in Iowa. But this secondary migration is a really important force that's shaping our state, isn't it?
It really is. And sometimes you'll see with secondary migrants that the movement into Iowa begins with companies that are very specifically recruiting people from other states where they have large populations of various ethnic groups and cultural groups that are there, and they may be looking for work. And so companies will go to those communities out of state and recruit them. And then you'll get families that will move here to Iowa. And then after that, when you get a key, you know, large enough number of families, then they often will self-recruit, and people, you know, cousins will come in, and other relatives and other family members from different states will come in and join family members here. And so you wind up having thriving communities, as we have had for decades from all around the world. And you know, more and more people living together.
Right. I can imagine that that increases the possibility for success pretty dramatically, to move into a community that has a safety net and has people that you have connections with.
Absolutely. Very well stated. And that is what we see. It can be a difficult transition for people to move if they are used to, you know, living and being with large numbers, you know, in their family and a strong sense of community and ethnic identity. It can be very tough for initial flows of refugees and migrants to make that adjustment. And we do tend to see that they often do better if they've got their families with them, larger numbers of families. And it's really neat to see in a lot of our communities in Iowa, when you reach sort of a key number of folks, that you'll see growth in, for instance, entrepreneurship and the creation of new businesses and new jobs, ethnic markets and different businesses that are owned by these different cultural communities that are coming in. And we're seeing the reinvention of towns and schools that may have been shrinking and even dying in some cases in their population numbers are really coming back to life because of migration and because of the influx of new people coming
in. Absolutely. We've seen that in Carroll. We've seen that in Denison. We've seen that in many communities in Iowa. Mm-hmm. It dramatically changes the community.
Absolutely.
In many ways. We talk about it and it makes it sound so simple, but moving to another country, moving across the country to another state, starting your life from scratch, often coming with very little to your name, is an incredible challenge. Tell me a little bit about some of the challenges that these migrants are facing.
Sure, it can actually be very difficult. And many of the migrants that we have here in the state are technically, legally classified as refugees. And refugees, by definition, have been forced to flee against their will from their home country, had to cross borders. And that's almost always because of war, ethnic conflict, genocide, and horrific things. So to be forced to leave your home country and to wind up in a refugee camp, maybe for years, and then ultimately maybe a few people will make it to a third country of asylum like the United States and then wind up in a place like Iowa, it's an extraordinary journey. It can take years. We see a lot of challenges with language barriers. A lot of the refugees may not be receiving education or training in things that they need, such as language. And so they'll have language challenges, literacy issues, depending on their background. They may have challenges in reading and writing in their native language, let alone in English, right.
Michelle, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to talk a little bit more. Michelle Devlin is a professor of global public health at the University of Northern Iowa. This hour, we're talking about migration to Iowa. Right now, we're focusing on people coming to the state today. We'll also take a historical look in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week, and all this week we're going to be asking the question, is this home? And we're going to be asking it in a number of different ways. Today, we're talking about migration throughout Iowa history. In a moment, we will shift to a more historical view, but right now we're focusing on who's coming to Iowa today. What is pulling people here, and what challenges do they face when they get here? Michelle Devlin is with me. She's a professor of global public health and an emergency medical technician in the Department of Health, Recreation, and Community Services at the University of Northern Iowa. Michelle, before the break, we were talking about some of the really incredible challenges that people face moving to Iowa, whether that they are part of the initial immigration procedure or secondary migration, moving to Iowa from somewhere else in the country, the language barriers, the literacy, integrating into the education system. We have seen the kinds of benefits provided to refugees pulled back in recent years. Is that creating a health crisis for many of the refugees who live in Iowa?
Well, we definitely have seen a number of different health issues with the refugees. It is a tougher adjustment to make. We do tend to see more challenges now with mental health, stress, anxiety, depression, loneliness, different health equity issues and inequity issues. We do a lot of work with refugees in the area of chronic diseases, some infectious conditions, and just all of those can really be impacted if populations are coming in and may or may not have access to the kinds of health care that they need. And it's a challenge for our health providers as well, again, where they, you know, may be running clinics or hospitals and are now providing services to patients easily speaking dozens and dozens and dozens of different languages, then also different cultural beliefs, different, you know, understandings of diseases and why they occur and how you treat them and what you do with them. I do a lot of work in the area of traditional healing and traditional health practices among populations, and that's a whole nother subject in and of itself that's really fascinating. But many, many different, you know, challenges that we're seeing among these populations.
Are we seeing food insecurity issues in Iowa among these populations?
We can see that even among our population within Iowa that is not made up of refugees or immigrants coming in. Again, health inequities and challenges to, you know, because of poverty, just, you know, lower socioeconomic status and, you know, being able to access food and healthy food. We do see with migration that very often dietary patterns change significantly, and what they may have been eating back home in a, you know, in a home country is very different than what they may be eating in a new community and in a host country. And actually, ironically, in many cases with migration, their nutritional status can decrease because they may be exercising less, they may be moving less, and then eating food that may be, you know, simple carbohydrates, simple sugars, and those kinds of things. And we see an increase typically in diabetes among immigrant populations.
We were talking earlier about people coming here from many different parts of the world and then secondary migration from different parts of the country. Are we seeing a lot of refugees or migrants arriving from Central America? These are the people who have been in the news a great deal recently, being driven out of their countries by so many pressures. Are we seeing an influx in Iowa?
We actually have had Central American migrants in Iowa for many, many, many years. In fact, during the Postville raid, the folks that ultimately were arrested for during that raid were actually from Central America. So we've had a strong influx of Central Americans in Iowa for well over a decade. They're actually all over the United States, and they can be very vulnerable to labor trafficking and abuses. They are sometimes, you know, sort of in this underground black market related to labor trafficking. And so we're concerned about that. We see an increase in climate change, migration, and a number of organizations consider a lot of those Central American refugees to be climate change migrants. We actually have within Iowa a fairly large population of folks that are here on territory or treaty status that come from the Pacific and are basically climate change migrants. They come from places like Palau and the Marshall Islands and, you know, general Micronesia and those areas. And a lot of their communities and countries are going underwater with climate change, and their economies are becoming very affected. And because they have territory status, they can legally come back and forth with to the United States. And so we do see an increase in those folks within America in general, as well as within Iowa.
We are nearly out of time for our conversation, Michelle, and I know you're not an economist, but listening to what you were saying earlier about how these people are recruited by Iowa companies and fill jobs that Iowans who were already here don't necessarily want to fill, or we don't have enough people to fill those jobs. You talked about small communities that had been shrinking, actually growing. I mean, it sounds like you're saying that these people are really an essential part of our Iowa economy.
They are absolutely an essential part of our economy. They are not here randomly. They didn't just suddenly show up. They are very much being recruited or, again, joining family members to work in the state because we do have a population shortage and a worker shortage in key areas of the community. And they are really helping keep our state you know, thriving economically, and they're doing a terrific job again in revitalizing communities and school districts and business areas. And we're very fortunate to have them here in the state.
Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Charity, too.
Michelle Devlin is a professor of global public health and an emergency medical technician in the Department of Health, Recreation, and Community Services at the University of Northern Iowa. And now we're going to shift our view to history. As I said, people have been coming to Iowa from all over the world for more than 200 years. And with me to help us understand those waves of migration, historian Timothy Walch. He is director emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum and the author of many books. His most recent is Irish Iowa. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Charity. It's great to be back.
And I think before we start talking about waves of migration, we need to talk about a little bit of Iowa history, which is that it wasn't like this land was empty.
Right.
When we talk about settlement, I know there's this sense that settlers were filling all of this empty space. It was not empty space.
It wasn't empty waves of grain. It was a state occupied by First Nation people who had a very mature way of looking at the land, which was this was a gift from the Creator to be protected by all of these First Nation people. And it was the Europeans, of course, who pushed across the Mississippi River against the instruction from the federal government to mine lead. And then they saw opportunity and, of course, had very little respect for indigenous people and pushed them out of the territory of Iowa, which by the 1830s became the Iowa Territory. And then at that point, those initial settlers, European settlers or Americans of European heritage, began to invite other people and their countrymen, their fellow countrymen and comrades. And so what you see is a first wave of immigrants, say from about 1840, 1830s and 40s, up to about 1890. And it's Northern Europeans. It's particularly Germans, of course, but also British and Irish and Welsh coming to occupy the land, but also to take on employment, again, much as Michelle talked about, employment that people didn't want. Who's going to build those railroads across Iowa? Well, you know, these Irish people, they're poor, they're dirty, but they've got strong backs. And so they can lay the track and run the railroads. And so, in effect, the Irish in Iowa, among other things, built the railroads. They were into a construction and various service industries, much as today's immigrants are doing that. So from 1840 to 1890, and of course, Germans and Northern Europeans who had assets could buy land cheaply, $1.25 an acre. And so they got their life's dream, which was to establish a small farm. We were land rich.
Right.
Europe.
And that was part of the U.S. government's plan to push indigenous people
out. We were sending booklets over to Europe. Come. It was like the proverbial Florida land salesman. We were saying this is the richest land you can possibly imagine. We can grow more potatoes in Iowa than you could ever grow in Ireland. And so what you have are people, these extraordinary immigrants, and you see this in today's immigrants too. They were risk takers. They said, yes, we can go to a new land where we don't speak the language, we're not sure whether we'll be welcome, but we can embrace this experience. We will be optimists about it. And they, in fact, that first wave got into the hulls of leaky boats and came here. Many of them died. They lost children. They established small communities here because they had all that land. With the way Michelle was talking about building up a community, a haven. So you have communities like Pella and you have Decorah and elsewhere, Elkhorn, where people of a common ethnicity would in effect settle and create a little idealistic community of their own and then attract and draw others from their native lands. And so you built up these little ethnic islands. And because we had the land, it allowed people to expand. And that was important. So it wasn't as compressed as they were in East Coast cities. So up to 1890, it's primarily Northern Europeans. 1890 to 1924, it's more Southern and Eastern Europeans.
And we were talking earlier with Michelle about how often people will build communities.
Yes.
That are sort of based on their ethnicity, bringing to people
exactly.
with similar backgrounds together. Again, that was the pattern from 1840 through 1890 as
oh,
well,
Oh, absolutely,
right?
Sure. So that what you have ethnic neighborhoods in the cities along the Mississippi River. You have Little Dublin in Dubuque, and you have a similar neighborhood in Muscatine, and or Burlington, as it was, or Bloomington, as it was called, and Davenport and elsewhere. And the Germans as well established their little communities. They established newspapers. There was
and
churches. In fact, there's a wonderful story about a Norwegian who, upon seeing the Statue of Liberty and realizing that this was the size of New York City, they said, imagine if New York City is this big, how big must Decorah be? Because he'd heard about Decorah, and he was going to Decorah because of the newspaper, the Norwegian newspaper. So the bottom line is that we drew people. We were a magnet for Northern Europeans and then Eastern Europeans, the Czechs and the Slovaks. Greeks and Italians came from 1890 to 1924. And then because of national legislation, by 1924, we began to shut off immigration. And we established a quota based on the population, the ethnic population of the United States in 1890. And so it became heavily Northern European. So we began to restrict the number of people coming to this country and to this state.
We saw a real anti-immigrant backlash at that
point. All the way through the 19th and 20th centuries, we've seen periodic animosity on the part of people who were, oddly enough, of immigrant heritage themselves, saying, what's with all these new people, and why don't they speak English, and why can't they be like me? And so you have nativists in the 1850s. You have the American Protective Association in the 1890s. You have the Ku Klux Klan in Iowa in the 1920s and so forth. So there's always been a strong hostility. And then there was the eugenics movement. I don't know that it was super big in Iowa, but people who tried to use a fake science to imply that people of Eastern and Southern European heritage, for example, were mongrels. We had a book called The Passing of the Great Race, bemoaning the fact that white Anglo-Saxon Protestants were no longer dominant in the United States. So what you have is you have this hostility that leads to the 1924 Act. And then from 24 to 65, immigration is a trickle. Of course, we had World War II. We did welcome refugees after World War II, particularly from Eastern Europe, particularly Jewish immigrants who had been in displacement camps.
Right, who had not been welcome before
World
War II.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And there was hostility even during World War II, lest we forget the Japanese internment camps. So we've always been a nation that's been somewhat schizophrenic. We've welcomed people and we've pushed them away at the same time. And then in 1965, we became more welcoming in our tradition. We opened up the country to larger numbers of immigrants from Asia, from Latin America, and other countries, Africa. And we established what, in effect, became something of chain migration. You know, Michelle talked about pathways, in effect. Well, we always had pathways. And so people would invite others, and it was more informal. The 19th century was not as much of a bureaucracy. Now it's far more difficult for people to come into the country because it just takes a long process in terms of application, whether you're a refugee, what kind of status do you have, what kind of visa do you have, and so forth. People in the United States in the 19th century would wander into this country through Canada or come across the border from Mexico into Texas and just establish themselves. They may not have had even a birth certificate or any indication, and they were there. They had children, and so it was a very fluid population. We were one out of many, and the many were coming from all over the world. In some cases, just getting off a boat in New York or getting off a boat in New Orleans and getting on another one and sailing up to Dubuque. And who knew where they had come from? They were free. So it was a very fluid situation. And that's really the nature of the 19th century.
You mentioned the Southeast Asian immigrants. Of course, in Iowa, that was a significant influx in the mid-1970s
right.
as Governor Robert
exactly.
Ray really led an effort
After 1965, you bet the Taidan and South Asian communities were welcomed here and became an important part of our culture.
And, you know, that's one of the things we've talked about it recently, of course, with the death of Governor Ray. But
yeah.
It's something that so many Iowans are proud of And that kind of ignores the fact that, again, at that point, there was a lot of pushback. It wasn't necessarily a popular policy.
No, no. And I want to mention somebody who was very much working with Governor Ray at the time, Ken Quinn, of course, who's the head of the World Food Prize Foundation, who comes from Irish heritage himself, from Dubuque, a good Loras graduate, and Wallert High School, who helped Governor Ray bring those Asians from the Southeast Asia here. And so, yes, we've always had people in the state, too, of ethnic heritage who were optimistic about the future and the possibility and been advocates for other immigrant groups. So that's an important element to the story here in Iowa. We always had to have people say, come visit. It's not as if we're ever pushing back and these people are saying, I'm determined to settle. And as we heard from Michelle, they're being invited. In some cases, it's economic to do jobs that right. nobody else will do. And whether it's the Irish building the railroads or Hispanics working in construction or meat processing or, any other service industry, there are plenty of jobs.
Tim, we're going to take a short break. Yeah. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to talk about a period of migration in our history that we haven't touched on yet in just a moment. With me right now is historian Timothy Walsh. He is the director emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum and the author of many books. His most recent is Irish Iowa. And of course, you're welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week, and all this week on Talk of Iowa, we'll be asking the question, is this home? We will ask that question in a number of different ways throughout the week. And today we're talking about waves of migration throughout Iowa history. Historian Timothy Walsh is here with us, and he's going to stick around. But I want to turn to somebody else with a story about a wave of migration that we haven't talked about yet. Jocelyn Hickey Johnson is the author of Ropes in the Kitchen, An American Journey Through Generations. Many people in Iowa, especially Waterloo, Iowa, know her best by her nickname Rocky as the co-host of the Facebook series North End Update, designed to celebrate some of the great things happening in Waterloo and do some community building. And she is with me now. Hello, Jocelyn.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Wonderful. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. Happy Iowa Week.
Yeah, thank you very much. Now, your family was part of what is called the Great Migration, and that was a movement of Black Americans in the South, over a million Black Americans, moving north between the years of 1915 to 1930. And your great-grandfather came to Waterloo, Iowa in 1917, right?
Correct.
All right, so give me a little bit of background, because your family history that you've researched and that your father and your grandpa and your aunt and everyone shared with you goes back before Preston Hickey and his move to Waterloo. Tell me a little bit about your family.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for having me. My great-grandfather, actually my great-uncle, came here in 1906. And via the railroad, and he started working as an engine repairer in 1906. And then after years of developing skills there, he sent for the rest of his family, which included my great-grandfather, Preston Hickey, and he came here in 1917. So in 1906, there were literally very few African-Americans in Black Hawk County, and our family was some of the first.
And as the Great Migration went on, the railroad jobs and other jobs in Waterloo, Iowa, drew many more people from the South. Tell me a little bit about how that community grew.
Well, the community grew after more African Americans started sending for the rest of their families to come north to avoid some of the Jim Crow laws and also to find good work, but they didn't know they were replacing striking workers. So they didn't have a welcoming committee, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. It was an understatement to say that animosity was prevailing. There was the KKK involved, and a lot of African Americans had no housing, no access to health care. They basically lived in boxcars and stuff like that along the railroad. So it was very difficult, to say the least, to be an immigrant at that time from the South.
Well, and I think that a lot of us, when we learn about the Great Migration in our history classes, it focuses on cities like Detroit and Chicago, some of the bigger cities. But it was a significant force here in Iowa. And as you mentioned, I mean, these people were escaping terrible persecution down south and a lack of opportunities and terrible racism, institutionalized, legal at the time, yeah, racism. Yes. But it wasn't exactly paradise here. And you write about growing up in Waterloo and experiencing overt racism when you were a child, too.
Yes. I think any African-American that has been brought up in Waterloo, you know, you can just take a drive and see the difference in the neighborhoods. It's been overlooked for so many years, but there's been so much, you know, bad things that have happened that some of them just kind of required us, my family, to record the oral history. And finally, we documented it in the book. But yeah, there was a lot of racism that went on. I came from a biracial family, so I heard a lot of, I understood the Black struggle. I grew up in a Black neighborhood. So the racism was very prevalent in my life because, you know, it was up until 1966 is when it was finally legal for races to actually marry, you know, the two races, Black mm-hmm. and white. So this wasn't so long ago. And as Nicole Hannah-Jones mentioned in her 1619 presentation.
And another proud Waterloo person as well, although Nicole Hannah-Jones does not live in Waterloo anymore, but she grew up in Waterloo and, of course, is doing incredible work for the New York Times right now. Yes. But go on. She was saying in her presentation.
Well, what I liked about her presentation was that you were met at the door with a copy of the Constitution. And she explained that the Constitution, to justify itself, actually had to prove in unscientific ways that African Americans were not even human. So they did not have to comply to the fact that all men are created equal. If African Americans are not even considered men or women, then they don't have to be included in that. So, so that's the kind of attitude people had. Even though you were in the North, it's still that racism just reached across the country. And it's just so hard to overcome something so prevalent, you just can't overcome it. Because we started so far in the hole with those kind of thoughts.
And you have a truly extraordinary family, Jocelyn. I mean, your aunt is Anna Mae Weems, who, of course, is well known to many Iowans, one of Iowa's truly great civil rights leaders. So your family has been involved in this struggle for a very long time.
Yes. And I think that our family, some of the strengths that we've shared through the generations, for instance, my great-grandfather, the Waterloo Courier, wrote some great articles that helped me to document some of our family's information. And of course, Anna Weems, being my aunt, I understood that being Black was beautiful and my Blackness was something to celebrate. So those are some of the family strengths. But a lot of white Americans don't realize that African Americans had to be taught to love themselves, you know, so it wasn't something that just came natural, because a lot of times Black people felt that you weren't worthy or qualified to positions or other places in society. The Black church and the strength of the Black family really helped to empower a lot of African Americans and people of African heritage like myself. I remember when James Brown came out saying, "Say it loud, I'm Black and I'm proud." That was something really, really strange to my father. He would say, you know, I'd be dancing that in the living room and listening to that music. And he'd say, "No, don't say it that loud. Just sit down somewhere," you know, because generational Blacks were taught to not really celebrate their African heritage. So these are some things that were passed down for me. And I'm so thankful for that. Our family had a great sense of belonging here in Waterloo, because we are now six generations deep, as they say, here in Iowa.
Wow. Well, and Jocelyn, I was just going to ask you that because you are, anybody who's ever watched North End Update knows that you are proud to be a North End girl. And you really are working so hard to instill that sense of pride in so many other people. But there you were. You had grown up in Waterloo. Your dad had grown up in Waterloo. So you were already several generations deep by the time you came along. And yet you were made to feel like an outsider. Was there a moment where you overcame that and embraced Waterloo as home, as yours, just as much as it is anybody else's?
Well, yes. I believe, I think like a lot of other people, the 60s after 1968, when my book Ropes in the Kitchen takes place, I think that was a year of... all Americans remember 68 and 69. So much happened. And I just feel that in that year, I discovered, I think I got myself an Afro, you know, and I started celebrating my African heritage. And yes, belonging in Waterloo and knowing that my aunt was so powerful at that time, and she took me around, and I got to see her pride and her advocacy to so many people that were misrepresented or underrepresented, that, yeah, I believe I became empowered the year Ropes in the Kitchen takes place.
Well, that's wonderful. Jocelyn, thank you so much for talking with me, and thank you for all the work that you do.
Oh, thank you so much, Charity.
Jocelyn Hickey Johnson. She has written about her family's history in Ropes in the Kitchen, An American Journey Through Generations. And every week she sings the praises of things going on in the North End of Waterloo, Iowa through North End Update. You can find them on Facebook. A lot of great work being done. And we were just talking about how her family was part of the Great Migration, a movement of more than a million Black Americans moving from the South to the North between the years of 1915 to 1930. And Tim Walsh, our historian, is still with us. And Tim, that was a part of Iowa's migratory history that I guess we hadn't explored.
Sure.
We've been talking about people coming from other countries. But this movement of Black Americans from the South to the North was an incredible movement.
And it has the same common threads with the immigrant experience. They were being pushed out of the South by Jim Crow laws and hostility against people of color. They were being drawn to employment opportunities, in this case, unfortunately, a strike necessarily, but also other opportunities because white workers had gone off to war. But it, of course, led to certain friction and tension in communities across the United States and probably in Waterloo. And, of course, the unique challenge that Jocelyn talks about is the fact that people of color have always faced a sort of perpetual hostility. Yes, to some extent, they were welcomed here because they were terrific workers and they contributed so much to our economy, but then we would push back against them. And so that people of color, whether you're African-American or your Asian descent or even Hispanic, often feel unwelcome. And that's been a perpetual issue, I suppose, in the state. We are, generally speaking, a warm and welcoming people, but we're still predominantly Northern European. And so in that sense, although it is changing, it's a struggle within the whole question of, you know, who is Iowan and do we feel welcome? Because we're not perfect. We always have the challenge of being, on the one hand, being a better angel, but also then having that prejudice and hostility that continues to exist, perhaps not here as much as it is in other communities, but nevertheless in other states, it is a sort of a perpetual problem.
Des Moines was another destination for many Black Americans during the Great Migration. And so there were parts of Iowa that were really part of that movement. But we were talking earlier about, you know, obviously there was a lot of free land or available land that was made available in the early part of our history as a territory and then a state. But these are people who were coming for the more urban areas,
right,
for the cities. And we see an interesting pattern throughout history with that, too. I mean, you've talked about the Irish,
sure,
which weren't necessarily drawn to the land.
No, and in fact, it depended on how much wealth you had. And of course, people of color often, as sharecroppers, had very little resources to bring with them other than their determination and their hard work. And so they migrated to the cities where they worked in jobs, as did the Irish. And so if we didn't, in this case, as in Jocelyn's case, her ancestors worked, you know, in the rail yards, those same rail yards that had been laid down by Irish workers 50 or 75 years earlier. So the bottom line is the railroad was an economic engine for lots of immigrants who came to the state who said, I've got two strong hands and a strong back, but I don't have the money to buy the land to be a farmer. And so we do have industrial communities like places like Ottumwa and elsewhere where you have meat packing. And with people of color, we can't overlook too Buxton, Iowa, where there was an established black middle class and a coal mining town. Of course, the coal mining, once those industries disappear, then people move on. And that was really the important part of that story of the great migration north. And although it didn't necessarily happen directly here in Iowa, it's also the era of the Harlem Renaissance, the great flowering of black culture in New York that was a part and parcel to the whole movement of peoples. We're constantly on the move. And so we kind of heard that when Matt talked to those people about becoming new citizens. Are you going to stay in Iowa? Well, I'm not sure. You know, we've moved on, whether you are Irish or German. Yes, we always call Iowa home, but maybe we're going to move to Minneapolis or Kansas City or California because there's a better opportunity. And that's that sort of optimism. We're people on the move. We're people who embrace our heritage, but we're also not so deeply rooted that we aren't willing to take a risk and move someplace else.
Not all of us are very willing to learn our history these days. Tim, why do you think it's so important for Iowans to understand this history?
You know, Charity, what's been most interesting to me as an historian is the advertising we see on television for Ancestry and 23andMe. People are implicitly interested in their own history and how pleased they are to find out they came from this particular country or this particular region of a country in Europe. They're learning their heritage through science, which I think is important, but also genealogy as a hobby. And you see this again with Ancestry, the online ability to link up with who you are and who you have been and what traits, some of them medical, some of them cultural, do you have that make you who you are today? There's a wonderful book with a great title by Alex Shumatov called A Mountain of Names. And that's what we are. We're a mountain of names and of cultures. And this country in particular, we're such a wonderful, either we're a mosaic or we're a melting pot, but we're just a great mix of different cultures. And every time we go to a restaurant and taste a food we've never tasted, it's a result of somebody who's come here and worked hard or tried a new dance or a new tradition or read a book. And that's what makes this country unique of all the countries in the world, is that we are such an extraordinary combination of so many different cultures and so many different optimists.
And when we look into our history, we need to look beyond just our family, right?
Absolutely. And look at the commonalities that we all have with Central Americans. They're taking risks. They're fleeing oppression. They're coming for opportunity, just the same way your Irish or German ancestors did a century or more ago.
Well, Tim Welch, thank you so much for being here today.
Wonderful. Thanks for being here.
Tim Welch, he is the Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum and the author of many books. His most recent is Irish Iowa. This hour, we've been talking about waves of migration to Iowa throughout history. And this is our first day of Iowa Week. All this week, we're going to be exploring the question, is this home? Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to talk about what happens when Iowa stops feeling like home. We're going to dig into the history of the farm crisis in the 1980s and how that dramatically changed the face of our state and changed so many families as well. That's coming up tomorrow. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Matt Alvarez, Dennis Reese, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. I'm Charity Nebbe. You can follow us on Twitter at Iowa Public Radio. I'm there as well at Charity Nebbe. And of course, you can listen to our podcasts anytime. Just subscribe to the Talk of Iowa podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.